Freedom News Hour with Jake Towns, Walt Thiessen, and Gene DiNardo, Thursdays at 6 p.m. Eastern Standard Time on Progressive Radio Network.
Don't you know, we're talking about a revolution sounds.
And it's the Freedom News Hour, Surviving Meltdown. I'm your host, Walt Thiessen, here with my co-hosts, Jake Towns and Gene DiNardo, here on this Thursday, August 4th, 2011. And the big news today, coming out of Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrial Average taking a hit after about 2 weeks of down days, followed by one slight up yesterday. The Dow plunged 512.76 points. That's a 4.3% drop in one day. And it's got a lot of people really nervous, because apparently what's happening is people are pulling out of stocks, they're pulling out of precious metals, they're pulling out of everything, going back to the dollar because they're afraid of a coming recession. And this is kind of something that we were talking about here on the Freedom News Hour over the past few weeks. We were hinting that there might be something coming up this summer, and that there might be something that'll jolt the traders back from their vacations. Well, this could very well be it. And it wasn't just the Dow that was hit today. Jake, what happened with the S&P over the last period?
Well, the S&P from its recent highs has also been knocked down about 10%. And I think that the volatility index for the Dow Jones also hopped up quite a bit. And it was a pretty extraordinary day. Oil fell $5 a barrel. Gold prices briefly hit an all-time high in dollars in the morning at about $1,680 per troy ounce, and then was knocked back about $30. Gold and silver stocks took a large hit, in addition to the entire American stock market.
Yeah, it's been quite a day and quite a few weeks, too, a two-week period. This has been one of the most continuous periods of decline in the stock market in years, in many, many years, in decades even.
Hey, Walt, I was going to ask you a question, but you mentioned that people might be pulling out of gold and silver because of the upcoming recession. Now, what's the logic behind that?
Well, the traditional logic is that the safe haven has always been the dollar, because the dollar is the world's reserve currency. And what makes that a particularly interesting knee-jerk reaction, of course, is that all this is happening because the dollar is in such dire straits, and that's what's been leading to the debt crisis and everything else happening along the way. So when Wall Street gets in trouble, it's interesting that they're, in a sense, kind of like running into a burning barn.
From one burning barn to the other.
That's right, yes. The thing that's striking to me, well, there are a number of points that are striking, not the least of which is that the media doesn't seem to understand what's going on. In fact, the LA Times, when they reported on this today, they quoted Michael Purvis. He's a chief strategist at BCG Financial, as saying, "It's almost a very simplistic thing here. There's just been indiscriminate selling. Markets work in strange and mysterious ways, and sometimes it takes a while for routes like this to get going." So, you see, it was all just purely random. This has nothing to do with anything that's been going on with the dollar. You can just go back to your TV sets. Everything's just fine. This is just normal Wall Street activity.
Right. I think what we're also seeing is that because the obvious thing that the media is tying this to is the recent debt ceiling crisis in D.C., which maybe we can spend a moment on later.
Sure.
But I think that one of the main pieces of news coming in is that the European Central Bank, not the Federal Reserve, but the European Central Bank has signaled that it will begin buying and actually was purchasing government bonds, I believe, for Portugal and Irish bonds today. So they, that the European Central Bank Securities Markets Program have been dormant for a few months, but leapt into action today. Italian and Spanish bonds were both over 6% for 10-year notes today. And I think that that's a key thing, is that if they, and, you know, the euphemism for the European Central Bank buying bonds is really adding more liquidity, which is just another fancy word for saying they're throwing money at the problem.
That's absolutely.
And I think
most likely new money, I would imagine, right?
Right. And what's also very interesting about this is the timing of it all, because August 2nd, just a few days ago, they had the vote on the debt ceiling, and August 9th is the next meeting of the Federal Reserve, the Federal Open Market Committee, and I'm sure that QE3 is going to be on the table, at least. So it'll be interesting to see that, and it'll also be interesting to see the Wall Street reaction to that, because the Fed will, of course, be doing whatever it can to not cause a market panic.
Well, I think we're already seeing the reaction from Wall Street, and in fact, I think it's going to continue. Also, a couple days ago, the Telegraph from the United Kingdom, one of their largest newspapers over there, published an article that said Europe's money markets are beginning to freeze up, similar to what happened in 2008. And that was published on the day that the so-called compromise was reached in Congress in the United States. But this is happening kind of in parallel to what's happened here in this country. The article said the European money markets have begun to seize up as pressure mounts on the Italian and Spanish banking systems, tracking the pattern seen during the buildup towards the financial crisis of 2008. The three-month Euribor OIS spread, the fear gauge of credit markets, reached the highest level in 2 years today. That was 2 days ago, jumping 7 basis points to 40 in wild trading. So that kind of ties into what you were talking about, Jake, where they're now trying to buy up the bonds, because I think what that really is a rather transparent effort to unfreeze those money markets that are starting to freeze up over there.
Right, and you have to also remember that America's money market funds, many of them are invested up to 40% in European debt and European instruments. So it really, both countries are being affected. And America's, specifically the money market funds, are heavily invested in these bonds, although most people have no idea that that's the case.
Oh, yeah.
An interesting thing about that I was reading, and it was tied into the debt crisis and the fact that the Treasury bonds could get a lower rating, is by law the mutual funds and various funds are required to carry a certain amount of AAA securities, and this would really affect the value of the securities. If they get a downward rating, they would no longer be required by law to carry the Treasury securities, and that's tied into all the different values and things like that.
That's true. In fact, Jake, wasn't there already one agency that has downgraded U.S. debt?
Right. We've talked about them on our show before. It is the Beijing-based in China, Dagong Credit Rating Agency. And they've been bearish on the U.S. dollar for quite some time, but although the S&P, Moody's, and Fitch believe that they all stated that they would continue giving U.S. Treasuries the top AAA rating, Dagong downgraded the U.S. debt from A-plus to A with a negative outlook. So there's possibly even lower downgrades going to occur from that company. Dagong is a quote-unquote independent company. They are privately owned, however, they are based in Beijing, China, and anyone that knows China knows that in some ways they are speaking for other folks.
Right.
Yeah, I wonder who. So it's interesting to see that, China, you also had government officials coming out. The People's Bank of China, Governor Zhou Xiaotuan, said that China's central banks will monitor U.S. efforts to tackle its debt. And the state-run Xinhua news agency blasted what it called the madcap brinkmanship of Americans' lawmakers. So it's... this whole move from the dollar is continuing, and it'll be interesting to see what happens with these herds of money flows, because the difference between 2008 and now is that you've had 3 years of dollar negative news continuing to come out and continuing to come out, and you have to realize that a lot of these investment firms and banks and what have you, they, if they liquidate funds or liquidate stocks, they are going to go into dollars. The question is, are they going to stay in dollars or not?
Yes.
And that remains to be seen. People have been watching the euro rates very closely. Europe has quite a bit of trouble, and in some ways, where is the money going to go? And I think that where the money is going to go is where we've seen European central banks, or central banks really across the world, starting to emigrate. And what they're doing is they're buying gold.
That's right.
Thailand added 19 metric tons to its reserves in June. Russia is a net buyer. Kazakhstan made another large buy. South Korea made a very large buy of gold, 25 tons, which is its first reported purchase since the Asian financial crisis in 1998. And for those listeners that may not be aware, in Asia, specifically China, Korea, to some extent Japan and other parts in Asia like Vietnam and India especially, gold is seen as a form of wealth. And I would even say in some ways money, definitely a sign of permanent wealth. And what happened back in 1998 in Korea was that they had this huge currency crisis where the South Korean currency, just the won, kept falling and falling and falling. And what they did in South Korea was they had television stations running massive campaigns calling on citizens to donate their gold jewelry so they could melt it down and use to pay off the country's debt. So in other words, the South Korean debt. And in just a few weeks, they were able to get about 6% of the population, this is amazing to me, about 3 million people, to patriotically hand over their necklaces, earrings, sports medals, and trophies.
For free?
For free. At least one woman donated her wedding ring. A cardinal of the Catholic religion donated his golden cross. Television stations ran kitschy giveaway your gold game shows, and they were able to get 200 tons. Now, they just bought 25. They brought in 200 tons of metric gold. It drove down the world price. But what they wanted to do was support their own currency, and what happened there, it plummeted. So that was the thing that the government went to the population and said, you know, we have this great, you know, patriotic thing that we need to do. Our currency's falling. We're all going to get poorer. So everybody, you know, hand over your gold.
Well, they were right.
Melted it down, and investors
I just
took
can't,
it.
It I
worked.
Can't see
it worked
that
great. They all got poor.
Right, right. So
let's all be in this together.
Yeah, and Mexico was also the largest buyer of gold in the year. They purchased $5.3 billion, or 98 tons of gold. Russia has purchased 48 tons worth $2.6 billion at current prices. So all over the world, and actually even smaller countries like Greece, Portugal, and Ireland are also buying gold. So that just tells you that that's where the central banks are going to be going. And the reason is it's a insurance for their currency. And now more than ever, it's seen as something that needs to be maintained and increased.
Jake, I don't know if you saw it. Maybe Gene, you saw it too. But on Monday, Reuters came out with an article, and this is actually showing the humorous side of this. If there actually can be a humorous side, believe it or not, there really is one. This is an article that came out of Russia that reports that Russian Prime Minister Vladimir Putin accused the United States Monday of living beyond its means like a parasite on the global economy and said dollar dominance is a threat to the financial markets. He said, quote, they are living beyond their means and shifting a part of the weight of their problems to the world economy. He said this to a pro-Kremlin youth group in Nashi. He said they're living like parasites off the global economy and their monopoly of the dollar. And I just found that to be hysterically funny because Putin and his government and his central bank have been absolutely ravaging the Russian economy at a rate of like 12 to 15% a year with their, parasitical living off of the economy and the way they handle their money. That was just the funniest thing I've ever seen.
No, it's only parasitical when it's somebody else.
I guess so. Yeah. Well, I suppose if anyone's going to know what being a parasite is, it would be him. I mean, he's an expert at it.
The main thing over
there. They
Russia
call it the free market over there.
Yeah, you had all the oligarchs that popped up during the 90s and ended up buying a lot of these companies and what have you for pennies, for a fraction of what they were worth, becoming fantastically rich. And a lot of those oligarchs have been smart enough to close out, and if they haven't been tossed in prison by Russia, they've gone into things like harder assets to kind of protect themselves too. So, yeah, the rich get richer and the poor get poorer is kind of like the story across the world.
Yeah, it's whoever you know. If you know the right people, you get rich. If you know the wrong people, you end up in prison. You know, it's a good deal.
The political economy is what it is.
Oh, political indeed. Well, of course, we have our own political economy going on over here, and that it's all been focused on what's been going on in Washington, where they talk about cutting expenses and raising the debt ceiling all at the same time, and of course they're not really doing that. But it's also had some interesting side effects, shall we say, in terms of how economists have been responding to that. And Gene, I know you have some interesting details about that.
Yeah, and there's two interesting things. We've been actually talking about this, how large of a share of the government spending is in the gross domestic products, anywhere from 25-30. It varies. And of course, when you slash that, it's going to have an effect. And this article goes into this. It quotes different sources, and the sources are kind of interesting too, but I'll read from it a bit. Emerging outlines of a deal to cut spending by at least $2.4 trillion over 10 years with a multi-billion-dollar down payment later this year would complete an about-face in the federal government's role from outsized spending in the immediate aftermath of the recession to outsized cuts going forward. Last week brought the disconcerting news that the economy grew no faster than the population during the first 6 months of the year, in part because of spending cuts that have already started by state and local governments, and also the federal government is also starting that too. And this one economist, Mohammed El Erian, who's the chief executive of the bond investment firm PIMCO, said, unemployment will be higher than it would have been otherwise, growth will be lower than it would be otherwise, and inequality will be worse than it would be otherwise. He goes on to say, we have a very weak economy, so withdrawing more spending at this stage will make it even weaker. Goes on to say the economy grew at an annual rate of only 0.8% during the first half of the year. Millions of homes remain empty. 25 million Americans could not find full-time jobs last month. Even without the debt ceiling deal, federal spending is in rapid decline. Little remains of the federal stimulus money. Payroll tax cuts are set to expire, although I do think Obama wants to continue them. The combination of the budget-cutting government's plans and the grim economic news is likely to increase pressure on the Fed, which will hold a scheduled meeting August 9th to reconsider its declaration earlier this summer that it has done enough to aid economic recovery. Then Randall Krosner, who's an economic professor at the University of Chicago, he goes on to say, from an accounting point of view, it seems obvious that you would reduce GDP if you cut government spending. But the key is really the impact on consumption and investment. If you reduce government spending, and if people think that reduces uncertainty about the tax burden down the line, they may be more comfortable with spending. I think he's stretching it a bit there, but and goes on to say, economists who have examined the historic record, however, say the evidence is clear that the immediate impact of spending cuts outweighs any short-term benefits to confidence. When you look at the history of these things, the finding is that we shouldn't be kidding ourselves. When you do fiscal adjustment in the near term, it does have an adverse impact on economic growth. That's Paulo Mauro, who's the chief of the Fiscal Affairs Department at the International Monetary Fund and the editor of the book Chipping Away at Public Debt. So I thought the sources were kind of interesting on that, but we have talked about it, and it's such a large part of government spending, such a large part of the economy, that it's going to have some effect. I mean,
and that's the funny thing too, because what the gross domestic product, or for the United States, what the GDP is, it's the sum of every American company worldwide. So global American companies, whether they're Kraft or ExxonMobil, their entire transactions are counted in GDP as well. And the thing is, that's really just a measure of economic activity. What you really want to measure somehow is, people getting wealthier. And also, with GDP being measured in dollars and with inflation of goods being, much higher than what's currently stated, I think it's becoming pretty obvious that GDP on the net is decreasing. So you have net economic activity decreasing. It doesn't really tell you whether people are getting wealthier or poorer, but if you just take a look at what people thought their homes were worth or what they thought their bank accounts were worth, I do happen to believe that the people's standard of living overall is declining. People don't even have jobs anymore.
That's interesting, because now that you mention that, if they're taking into account American companies and what they earn worldwide, the government portion of our gross domestic product is probably even larger. I mean, as far as real dollars that are earned in our country.
Well, hey, making highways in Afghanistan and building military bases in Iraq aren't, they are economic activity. I'm not going to say that they're not, but, no one's getting any richer from that. And, maybe you could argue the Afghanistanis are, but from the highways, but, there's so much war and stuff over there, I'm sure that cancels it out. That's the whole thing that's occurring in our country too. The government spending is making the whole country poorer. because the governments have to get it from, they have to get their funds from somewhere. They can either print it up or they can take it from people that would have otherwise had the funds to do whatever they wanted with, which, whether it's to save it or spend it or do whatever the heck they want to.
Which is that's a great point. And even if the gross domestic product would in numerical values be lower, it would be what people wanted to spend it on and what they wanted to do. And that's a form of wealth right there. I mean, to not have a choice is hardly a form of wealth as far as I'm concerned.
Sure. Sure. One of the things that came out of the budget debate in Washington that culminated in their special deal this past Tuesday was that nobody was really happy with it, but particularly probably the one who was most unhappy with it was one we would expect, and that would be Congressman Ron Paul of Texas, of course, the Republican candidate for president in 2012. And at his website, he made a particularly cogent, I should say, statement on the whole situation. He said, quote, "While it is good to see serious debate about our debt crisis, I cannot support the reported deal on raising the nation's debt ceiling. I've never voted to raise the debt ceiling, and I never will." And then he goes on to say, "This deal will reportedly cut spending by only over $900 billion over a 10-year period, but we will have a $1.6 trillion deficit after this year alone, meaning that those meager cuts will do nothing to solve our unsustainable spending problem. In fact, this bill will never balance a budget. Instead, it will add untold trillions of dollars to our deficit, and this also assumes the cuts are real cuts and not the same old Washington smoke and mirrors game of spending less than originally projected so you can claim the difference as a cut." And boy, it was so good to hear that, because I don't think I heard anybody in the media pointing out the likelihood. And of course, we don't even know what's in the bill yet. We haven't actually seen the details of it. But you can bet your bottom dollar, what's left of it, the inflated dollar, that is, that when we actually see the final budget, what we'll see is that the cuts were cuts from what Obama originally wanted. They won't be cuts compared to, like, last year's budget, which means they're phantom cuts. They aren't anything real.
Exactly. That's how they figure things.
Yeah, and there is no guarantee that even these cuts will occur in the future, and I think that's, you know, very important, you know, for our listeners. Like, when the government says, you know, the cuts that they're doing is, okay, they're projecting to spend, say, $1 trillion more, so next year, you know, in addition of you know, their tax revenue and everything, and instead of that $1 trillion, they're saying, well, we'll just spend 0.9 trillion instead. It's pretty ridiculous, and it's funny that the way it's been structured is that a super committee has been formed in Congress, where the majority, the Democrat and Republican majority and minority leaders, both get to decide and pick three people from Congress to sit on this committee. This committee is charged with coming up with another set of budget cuts. By Thanksgiving, and it will be submitted to the House, and there will be no opportunity really for debate. It will be an up or down vote that needs to be taken. If there is no up or down vote, then and I did read through the bill, but it's a little bit tough to understand. Somehow there's going to be massive spending cuts on everything else that theoretically both the Republicans and Democrats don't like. So what's very interesting about this, and I believe Mr. Paul as well as other commentators have pointed out, is that the formation of this super committee itself, because, you know, Congress is charged with, you know, choosing what to spend money on, is the constitutionality of it is very, very odd. And it's placing the rights of Congress in... You know, it's going to be a tough vote, because if you vote against whatever they're doing and that doesn't get passed, you could, in effect, put into play these very large spending cuts, which might actually be better off than what's there. But it's like they're backing themselves into a nice little corner.
And these spending cuts that will go into place if it's not passed, are they specific like cuts or just general or?
Well, the ones that I've read in the bill, like I've gone through the bill, and it's just like Walt was saying earlier, it's just cuts on the future spending into the future. I didn't get the actual figures. I haven't actually read it anywhere. All that you see in the media is reporting just big cuts in defense and discretionary stuff. I haven't seen any specifics on it.
Mm-hmm.
And you mentioned Dr. Paul's reaction to it. Not only did he condemn this idea of the Super Congress as being unconstitutional, but he pointed out that, quote, despite the claims of his bill's proponents, there is nothing to stop the commission from recommending tax increases, which means you could have a huge tax increase just on a quick yay or nay vote. Bang, it's done. All because the super commission decided that we're going to have a tax increase. I mean, that basically disenfranchises the entire country. Not that we have much
super
franchise
committee.
Left.
But
yeah, I think the whole thing is, and people are already talking about how, like, there needs to be some. There was an article on Bloomberg that currency intervention is revived as the Fed may ease. Really, in that the Japanese have been selling yen to try and get their currency to weaken. Brazil has been having lots of quote-unquote problems with their currency getting stronger. The Swiss moved in to try and weaken their Swiss franc. And every of these Keynesian economies is following the Keynesian playbook, which is let's promote exports by cheapening our currency and printing it up. And it's, I think we're going to probably see more of this. And like Gina mentioned, August 9th, next week, next Tuesday, when the Fed meets, they're going to be probably talking quite a bit about asset purchases, and who knows where the Dow will be at that point.
And how do they stop it? Because, like you said, they're following the playbook. This is the way every central bank has always believed they should behave. But even when they're all acting in unison, it isn't turning the economy around. In fact, it's showing signs of tearing the economy apart. So what does the Fed do differently? I don't honestly know what the Fed's going to come up with. I suspect it's going to be, like you say, some other new form of QE, which, of course, will do nothing except just throw more money onto the fire. But I don't see any way that the Fed can turn this around. Do you?
Well, I think
if you watch the way that these things go, because, you know, even – like, yeah, sure, there's different countries dealing with it, but if you take a look at, like, for instance, what happened to Argentina during the 1990s, you know, there's nothing to say that that can't happen to the entire world on a global basis, because, you know, all inside each country is different regions as well, and the world itself is also just different regions at the end of the day. Try to borrow money. When it comes to, okay, we can't borrow money, well, we need to print it. And then when they print it, you start problems with that again, and you need to borrow more money, you can't do that. What ends up happening eventually is you start scheduling repayments on the debt. It doesn't work out. And then you start having the government stepping in there, like they did in Argentina, confiscating pension funds, doing whatever it can to increase its revenue base. Because with the other thing that is quite important about business activity is these governments live off of commercial activity. There's, you know, corporate income taxes here in the U.S. that do account for a sizable amount of the federal budget, I believe about $300 or $400 billion in taxes. But in Europe, that's a huge part, and they tax the corporations over there like crazy. And that's going to be very, very detrimental also to the governments, and they're going to be trying to secure the revenue, what they call revenue, what we call taxes, any way they possibly can.
And Gene, I know you have something you want to add to that, but we're at the half-hour mark. We got to take a quick break. We're going to come right back to you after the break. Plus, we're going to be talking about a number of other things that have been going on, including the fact that not only has gold been setting new highs, but the recent sell-off is setting up a new situation for gold and silver to move forward. Plus, we're also going to be taking a look at some of the radiation count coming out of Japan and how that's been hitting its highest level. So you want to stay tuned. This is the Freedom News Hour, Surviving Meltdown here on the Progressive Radio Network, and we'll be right back. Yeah, run back and turn up the radio dial, because we're back here on the Freedom News Hour, Surviving Meltdown. And Gene, I know you've been waiting over there with bated breath because you had something you had to throw in there, but we had to stop for the break. So, Gene, what were you going to tell us about the debt crisis?
About the debt crisis. Well, I was just going to agree pretty much with Jake as far as I do think that the entire world could get in kind of a plane with what happened to Argentina in the 90s. And it's basically because no matter what they do with the currencies, the production is the key. I mean, the product, how much product is out there and what people are manufacturing and consuming. And So if the entire world just decides to throw money at the problem, that's what we'll have. And the shame in all that is, even though, you know, you could say, well, at one point we had $50 for every, you know, this unit or product, and now we have 100. What's the difference? It's just twice as much money. It doesn't mean anything. But, you know, anytime they create money, it's a form of redistributing wealth, and we know how it usually ends up. You know, it seems like the rich get the best deal on it, and the bankers and everything, and so that's what happens, and that's the sad thing. But
it is a sad thing, and getting back to Congressman Paul's commentary from his website, he says, what should bother Americans most is that under the cover of the debt ceiling circus, we learned from a recent GAO one-time limited audit that the Federal Reserve secretly pumped $16 trillion into American and foreign banks over 3 years. All the Fed's fat cat cronies were taken care of at the expense of the American public. To put that into perspective, he says, our entire national debt is $14.5 trillion, and our annual deficit will be about $1.6 trillion, meaning the Federal Reserve created and appropriated more than our entire national debt to banks around the world in a few short years. We have been fighting in Congress these past few weeks over raising our debt ceiling by $2 trillion, an amount the Fed secretly gave away to just one big bank.
Amazing.
Absolutely appalling, but nevertheless, that's what's been happening. And the thing is, like you guys are pointing out, you can throw all the money at you want to, but all you really end up doing is throwing money into the fire. Or more precisely, you end up building the fire by throwing in all the extra money. And the fire is the destruction of the economy, because there's absolutely no way to avoid the basic law of economics. When your money supply increases, the value of each unit of money is going to decrease. It doesn't happen immediately, but it always, always, always happens. And the net losers, as you guys have been pointing out, is the little guy, us, the laborers, the middle class, you know, the poor. We all are the ones who get hammered by this. So this is not just some isolated, you know, academic debate taking place in Washington, D.C. This is basically Washington and the bankers colluding together to figure out exactly what method they're going to use to steal from us in order to bail themselves out. And it's just a continuation of an ongoing problem. It doesn't matter whether you're talking about the liberals, doesn't matter whether you're talking about the conservatives, doesn't matter whether you're talking about the moderates, they're all in on the same game. And that's the one takeaway that we should all take from this. At least that's my view on it. You think differently, Jake?
No, I agree with pretty much everything you said. I mean, we're going to be seeing quite a bit of instability and probably very, very high volatility, at least probably in the short term. And who knows, maybe in the long term too. And it'll be interesting to see what happens, you know, kind of day by day in these markets.
Yeah, it's becoming interesting in the sense of maybe live in interesting times, a Chinese curse, and of course that's what we're facing up to at this point. I would say that it's not the only thing that's been happening. I mean, we have been spending all the show so far on this, but there are other things that are happening, and as I mentioned before the break, there is some rather alarming news coming out of Japan regarding the radiation levels. Gene, what are the details on that?
Yeah, this is interesting, and it's funny how the media approaches this, because as we know, for at least a month, it was just, you know, headlines every day. This was in the back pages, a small article, and it says radiation counts hit lethal level. Tokyo Electric Power Company reported its second deadly radiation reading in as many days Tuesday at its wrecked Fukushima Daiichi nuclear plant north of Tokyo. TEPCO said Tuesday it detected 5 sieverts of radiation per hour in the number one reactor building. On Monday, in another area, it recorded radiation of 10 sieverts per hour, enough to kill a person within a few weeks after a single exposure, according to the World Nuclear Association. Radiation has impeded attempts to replace the cooling systems and to bring the 3 melted reactors and 4 damaged spent fuel ponds under control after a tsunami on March 11th crippled the plant. So that is, you know, they're still working on it. And the thing, and this is tragic, but I did find something kind of funny about this whole thing. The 10 sieverts of radiation detected Monday outside reactor buildings was the highest the Geiger counters used were capable of reading, indicating the level could have been higher, Junichi Matsumoto, a general manager at the utility, said at the news conference. So apparently these guys can build a nuclear reactor, but they cannot afford a Geiger counter that would actually tell you how much radiation there actually is.
Just proving
well, in
that
some ways it might not matter too much. It's going to kill you if you don't want to be anywhere near it.
Yeah.
And I think that a lot of the problem has been from all the explosions at three of the four reactors. There's been so much rubble that the Japanese are sending in unmanned robots and heavy equipment to move the rubble, which, you know, isn't nearly as quick as using things there, but it does prevent the workers from becoming overexposed and dying.
And they said that's, they mentioned that. They said the robots weren't as efficient, but they, that's the only thing they can do right now.
And it's pretty amazing, too, because when you go back into both the European Central Bank meeting and also the Federal Reserve meeting minutes, they blame this nuclear, you know, the tsunami and radiation or what have you at this nuclear power plant as one of the main reasons why the world economy has had so much trouble. That doesn't really hold any water. Like, there's no reason for, you know, 6 months later for the American stock market to plunge 10% just because Japan's been having all this trouble.
That's
the systematic
hilarious.
Errors are related to exactly what we're talking about and what the mainstream media doesn't talk about, which is they're just creating more and more money, and that just makes everybody poorer and poorer overall.
That's exactly true. In fact, just this past week, I saw an article in Bloomberg entitled "Why the Debt Crisis is Even Worse Than You Think." They go on and on about all the different reasons why it's understated and so forth. And most of the stuff they point out is actually true. But the one thing that they studiously avoid bringing up is the role that the relationship of the money supply has to all the situation. The closest they come to touching on it at all is when they touch on the national debt figures. But they don't even mention the monetary system itself. And boy, if that's not a testament to just how out of touch the media are, even when they try to get in touch, I don't know what is. I mean, that just really sums it up for me.
Yeah, that doesn't seem too out of touch for Bloomberg. You know, that seems kind of the stuff I've read on Bloomberg seems to go that way. I mean, I think, and this is a generalization, of course, but I think they actually believe, you know, if the system is tinkered with in the right way, it can work. And that's just going on. Like, I think Alan Brown, that's one of her places where she writes quite a few articles there. And but you're right.
Yeah, and it's just beginning to come out about Alan Brown. Interesting you mentioned her because we had her on as a guest last year. People are just beginning to catch on to the fact that what she wants to do is basically do the same thing that the Fed's been doing, but just make it so that it's the government lending money to itself. So, you know, eliminate the smoke and mirrors and just do it, you know, boldly and brassly as if it's going to somehow, you know, make a difference.
Yeah, she wants to bring it down to the state level. She does, you know,
that's right. Yeah,
you have to give her credit. She wants to take the power away from the federal and, you know, have the states be able to have their banks. And I'm not sure what the extent of it is, but that, you know, the left criticism of the monetary system does go that route. They say, well, you know, why not just have the states, you know, have their banks and they can issue money. And
of course, the answer to that is, the reason you want to do that is that it would make it 50 times worse than having one bank, one central bank that can do it. Now you got 50 central banks that can do it. Oh,
right,
man,
that's the way the world. Yeah, that's exactly the way that the world is moving. Like, these newfound powers on the European continent is moving all those countries that fall in the European Monetary Union that use the euro into kind of like almost a super country economically. And there's been a lot of conjecture, I would say, or some conjecture, in that a lot of these new powers that are being created are really being controlled by Germany, because Germany was the country that needed to fork over the bailouts for Greece and Portugal. And really, they're the only country in the European Monetary Union that is still like a very large net exporter. All the rest of them are very socialist and have kind of not really contributing a whole lot to the world economy.
Yeah, Germany, you know, is an interesting subject because you consider, you know, it's a large welfare state. The wage rates are incredibly high, and yet, like you say, they're a heavy exporter. So, you know, they have something going there that would be worth study, I think. I mean,
well, they work hard.
Yeah, they work very hard, the Germans.
Well, you know, you mentioned Germany, and I saw an article this week in which one of the gold bugs, Jim Rickards, was talking about what's happened with the German bank and the overall monetary crisis in the Eurozone. And he makes a really interesting point. He says it's become more and more clear that there was no good way out. In other words, you could just have an outright Greek default, which would be highly disruptive, or Greece could have left the euro, and that's another bad outcome, not so much economically, but politically. Germany and France don't want that because it would lead to the unraveling of the entire euro project, which has been going on since the early 50s. So finally, Germany did what everyone thought they would have to do at the end of the day. They stepped up and they have created this new facility, the European Financial Security Facility, or ESFS. But they have given it, the facility, vast new powers. In Europe, for over 10 years, you've had the European Central Bank, which is the equivalent of the Fed, but they did not have the equivalent of a euro treasury. So the best way to understand the ESFS, for the first time, we have a European-wide Ministry of Finance. They don't call it that, but that's what it is, and it's run by the Germans. So, in effect, Germany will be dictating fiscal policy to all of the euro system from here on out.
Wow.
I think that's what the Greeks haven't realized at this point. They, the Greeks, like the fact that their banks are being propped up. They like the fact that the austerity budget is not going to be as bad as it was. But I think, in the short run, this is very positive for Greece because they won't have quite the austerity straitjacket that they would otherwise have been wearing. It's probably a positive for Greek growth, and it's less disruptive to the market. So that's the good news. The bad news, though, he says, at least if you're Greece or Italy or Spain or Portugal, is that from now on, your fiscal policy is going to be dictated by Germany. So this is what I call the financial Fourth Reich. I thought that was just a really interesting point that he made.
That is an interesting point.
Unbelievable. I mean, how all this thing is just kind of shaking out. And Jake, you found an interesting article at Mises.org that you wanted to bring up. I think it's a good one to bring up at this point because it really touches on the craziness of what everybody's been trying to do in terms of coming up with a solution to this monetary problem without actually identifying it as a monetary problem.
Yeah, it's interesting. Dr. Robert Murphy over at Mises.org, M-I-S-E-S.org, wrote an article called Saved by a Trillion Dollar Coin, ? And he wrote some of the more wacko ideas of these Keynesian economists to try and evade the debt ceiling, and he examined them scientifically. And one of them that came up was, how about the Treasury creates two $1 trillion coins? He said, well, why don't you make them out of platinum and deposit them into, from the U.S. Treasury, mint these coins, deposit them into its account in the Federal Reserve, and then write checks on the proceeds. And you can, and that way, you have $2 trillion more of assets, and then you don't need the debt ceiling. The $14 trillion would go down to about $12 trillion, and then you'd be able to go off and spend whatever else you wanted. His second idea was to have the government sell the Federal Reserve an option to purchase government property for $2 trillion. The Fed would then credit these proceeds to the government's checking account, and then once Congress lists the debt ceiling, the president could just buy back the option for a dollar, or the option could just expire in 3 months or something. And then there's other ways that this Fed could achieve a similar result, like making huge loans like it did during 2008, like $16 trillion worth of loans and purchases to bail out the financial sector. And he went on to examine them. And, first of all, if you made a $1 trillion gold coin or a $1 trillion $1 trillion platinum coin, I think I'm not sure if there's enough platinum to even do it at the current prices. But what he said is, they wouldn't do this in and of itself. What they could do is the Treasury could, they don't even need a platinum coin. They could take something like, and he uses the example of a paperclip. Treasury Secretary Geithner, he could take a paperclip off of his desk, sell it to the Fed for $2 trillion, and then the Fed can just buy write up a check, made it out to the Treasury, and draw it on the Fed, and whammo, you've lowered the debt ceiling by $2 trillion. And he goes on into the semantics of it, and really, they could do this. Obviously, the only problem in this whole idea would be the Fed's balance sheet would have some problems, and you might see downgrades, and the assets obviously wouldn't be really increased by $2 trillion. But
when has that ever been a problem?
Well, that's the thing, because even right now, the Federal Reserve books are not marked to market. Like, a lot of the really bad derivative debt that they bought from AIG, for instance, and many other financial firms during the 2008 meltdown, they're not marked to market. No one knows what the heck they're worth. So really, the Federal Reserve is, by standard accounting rules, it's insolvent even right now. But because they don't have to mark to market, they just, fix up the balance sheet. Oh, everything evens out.
Okay.
And the whole thing is that, what this would do, it's just, all it's doing is legalized, counterfeiting. It's, debasing or devaluing the money. It's teaching all Americans that what Robert Murphy writes is that more and more Americans are learning that saving and frugal living is a sucker's game because the Treasury and the Fed will simply create the money to bail out their rich buddies, like bankers and what have you.
And those those are the logical endpoints of, the money production system, though. I mean, what they're trying to say is, we can actually tinker with this thing and, tune it. And those ideas, I think, are just where it would logically go in the end. I mean, if you take it further. I mean, this whole thing of you can actually, what are you going to say? Okay, it's okay to manufacture money at will, but only this much, only a certain amount. Only, we're going to watch these numbers. And that's all just fantasy, as we know and we're finding out. I think he's pointing out how ridiculous it is.
He is pointing out how ridiculous it is. And more than that, he points out it isn't just a case of the Fed balance sheet would be completely out of balance because of this $2 trillion paperclip, but the financial markets would absolutely have a cow over the whole thing. I mean, it would absolutely send the whole financial market thing into a spiral, a death spiral, to be
which is an interesting, right? That's an interesting comment, Walt, because why didn't they go into a death spiral over when they're buying all these crummy securities, at par value? And
well, you know what it is? It's kind of like the old adage about how to cook a frog. Do you know how to cook a frog? You don't do it by throwing the frog into boiling water, because if you do, he'll just jump right out as fast as humanly possible. But if you put the frog into the water and then turn the heat up very, very slowly, you'll very slowly boil him to death. Because
he'll
just get nice and warm and comfortable and fall asleep.
That's a good analogy.
That's pretty much what's happened with the financial markets. They do it slowly, do it a little piece at a time, until finally they've killed the frog.
Yeah, and I think the whole thing they worried about during the TARP was if it was too drastic. They're saying, well, we got to do this, and we got to do it fast. What's going to happen to the markets? And they kept reassuring everybody. But, they would have rather have done it over a period of time.
But, of course,
and they threw whatever they had at it.
But,
the other reason to have, sound money, in other words, money that has some backing to it and just can't be printed up at will, the other main reason to have that is what money is meant to be is like a tool for economic calculation. So you have all these firms out there that, one firm takes a massive hit on euro versus dollar fluctuations, and another firm might make out quite a bit. It turns, business into a little bit more of a gambling game that isn't, as nearly as much focused on serving the customers. Like a lot of the Argentina firms that survived the hyperinflation were just either speculation, flat-out speculation on stocks, or they would stock up on a certain item that they knew people would need, like food, and just hold it out to a certain point, and then sell it for profit. It's pretty ridiculous, and it messes up the entire economic system.
You're right, and it takes the value off production, right, and it puts it on this speculation, and that is involved in the currency. And a lot of people say, well, the Constitution says only the Treasury can mint currency. I don't know why, to go out there. I don't know why any government has the right to currency at all.
that's a really good point. Why does the government have the right? People automatically assume that the government should be the one issuing the currency, but I think all of history tells us that's a horrible idea because governments repeatedly, over and over and over and over and over again, debase the currency that they're supposedly in charge of. They never hold true to it.
Mm-hmm.
Ever. They just don't do it. It's not the way governments behave, and yet people assume that the government should be in charge of the currency. It's the same thing we were talking about a minute ago. Why is it that the financial markets haven't reacted so badly to all these stupid financial purchases by the Fed that basically inflated the money supply? And I think they're finally starting to catch on. I think they're finally starting to realize that this whole idea of having level stable currency is actually a pretty darn important thing. But even so, they're taking so long to catch on. And to be perfectly blunt, a lot of them make a lot of money off the fact that the system is so unbalanced.
I was going to throw that in there. I mean, the stock market loves it. I mean, the more money production, the stock market goes. I saw this chart in this article. It was a couple of years ago, and it just basically, as money production went up, the stock market went up all through history. And so, why should they not like it? I wish we could, do that.
But they should also realize that for every dollar that they're making that way, they're costing the economy $3 in terms of value, not in terms of nominal numbers, but in terms of the amount of wealth value that is lost in it.
That's
the part that doesn't seem to sink in. It's quite remarkable that that doesn't happen, but I think as the whole economy continues to fall into recession and keep rolling around in recession, it's going to be doing that for quite some time. I think more and more people are finally going to start waking up and saying, hey, wait a minute, this whole thing, the whole thing is completely out of balance. Why is it out of balance?
And we talked about it on the show before, but the root cause really goes back to a book that I'm reading called Money, Bank Credit, and Economic Cycles by Jesus Huerta de Soto. And in the book, the first part of the book, he just really examines the root cause, which is the original intent of it's a violation of property rights. That's the main problem. Government does not respect property rights. And the way that they go about it is, they're in cahoots with the bankers to get this revenue from the people. And one of the ways that they go about it is that when you deposit money at a bank, notwithstanding like a CD, but like for your demand deposits, whether it's a checking account or most savings accounts, the bank is not keeping that money for you whatsoever. They're really, in the American banking system, pretty much just taking 99% of that and going out and buying assets or loaning it out to somebody else or doing whatever the heck they want with it. And that makes the entire system insolvent. And the only way that it's survived to this point is by having these central banks, which now all have to act in cahoots, like the U.S. Fed bailing out using $16 trillion worth of loans in the 2008 crisis to foreign central banks and foreign banks. So it all goes down to if you take a look at property law, and that's one of the things that happened in Argentina. Now that since we mentioned Argentina a few times already, like you can go on to the internet and look up some documentaries on this. When it did occur, and I talked to a couple folks from Argentina that lived during this time, you literally had people like trying to rip down the banks to get in and get out their paper currency so they could spend it. But it wasn't there. It had already been spent. The banks were all gone. So what they did, and Citibank, for instance, was there, their Argentinian branch, and these banks were just all closed down. The government closed everything down. They said, however many pesos you have in your account, you're only allowed to take out 400 pesos electronically every month. And that's how they do it. They just have a complete lockdown, and people just overnight become poor.
Wow.
It's just awful when you think about it.
Yeah, I remember being in Mexico once, and a friend of mine was living down there, and we went into a bank, and I noticed the interest rate was 27% for a CD. And I said, whoa, I go, that's a pretty good return. He goes, yeah, I keep my money in American banks at like 3%. I go, how come? He goes, well, the thing is, it's 27, but you might come in, at the end of 6 months, and they tell you to come back in 6 months. It's not there.
Meanwhile, it's lost 50% of its value.
Yeah, exactly.
Well, we're near the end of the show, and before we sign off, I want to point out that you can always check on what's coming up with the latest and greatest of future shows by visiting our website at www.freedomnewshour.com. We don't have guests on all the time, but when we do have a guest on, that's going to be your first clue about who the guest is going to be and what the topic's going to be about. And, of course, we're always working on trying to get new guests on here. And, guys, I guess we've kind of reached the end of the hour here, but it's been a pleasure as usual. Gene, I'm going to go to you first. Do you see anything changing in this overall scenario?
Not really. I mean, it's hard to tell the future. I think it's just kind of a consistent thing that's going to happen, although there could be some disruption, but it just seems to be a path they're taking, and they're not making any changes, so I think we're just in for more of the same.
Jake, do you see anything different?
Well, the funny thing is going to be, really back in the 2008 crisis, you had commodities got crushed, whether it was oil. Oil went from 150 down to, I think, below $40 a barrel at one point. It got crushed again today. It went down $5 a barrel in just a single day. I think it's at about $87 a barrel. Gold went from, I think, somewhere around $1,000 an ounce to $700 an ounce. Now it stands at $1,600. And you had gold bounce up to 1680, and then all of a sudden around noon get taken down. And I'm sure that the folks, GATA, you know, we had Bill Murphy on from GATA before. They have a big conference in London, the middle of London going on right now, in the middle of the, possibly the second London gold pool, going on. I think it's going to be interesting to see how that, price changes over time and, whether that, obviously for them to knock down the gold price a lot lower, I think people are just going to buy it all up.
Yep, we're out of time here, but, Jake, it's been a pleasure as usual. And we'll see you all next week on the Freedom News Hour, Surviving Meltdown. Goodbye, everybody.
See you next week.
Stay free.